So again, let me say what a joy it is to be here. Thank you for having me. And I just want to say how incredibly blessed I am to serve our congregation, which is almost exactly 60 miles due west of here in Stockton, Illinois. The church was founded by Universalist farmers in 1899. And they have worshiped there every Sunday since, and the church they built and dedicated and paid for in the year 1900. But before I served in Stockton, I had a long history with the Unitarian Universalist faith of my birth. I was raised in two historically Unitarian congregations, the First Parish in Concord, Massachusetts, whose sanctuary was once home to the likes of Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, and the Birmingham Unitarian Church, a 50-year-old humanist congregation in the wealthy suburb of Detroit, Michigan, known as Bloomfield Hills. I was raised, as are many of our children, with a healthy distrust of organized religion, rebelling against the superstitious teachings of a bygone era, and imbued with pride in our own faith's history of reason within religion and our leadership in the quest for freedom. First from the tyranny of dogma, then from human servitude, then from gender oppression, and so on. I was also brought up to think of our members as transplants, as seekers of truth for whom the churches of their parents held little value and who sought refuge amongst our liberal religious ranks. This characterization of Unitarian Universalism as a chosen faith was celebrated even as I grew, with multi-faith education and coming-of-age ceremonies where we teens would profess what we believed after a year of intense study. And I was raised in a family and a congregation full of liberal Democrats who claimed that social progressiveness was the only brand of American politics that coincided with our faith. I remember my pride at being able to vote for Bill Clinton in my first presidential election as an 18-year-old, and my staunch opposition to the war in Iraq during my 20s. But this is not a complete picture of who we are. I was called to Stockton in 2010, and very quickly my preconceived notions of our faith were challenged. My first shock came in the form of the diversity of opinions within my congregation about gun control. I was astounded to find when I asked for a show of hands as to how many of the congregants owned firearms that nearly half of the hands in the sanctuary went up. My first board president's Christmas card displayed him, his wife, and their two daughters alongside their hunting dogs, decked out in forest camouflage, each holding a rifle that looked bigger than the next. The dogs, thankfully, were unarmed, but were the only ones in the picture without firearms. Likewise, I was amazed to learn that a good third of my active members were direct descendants of the founders 114 years ago. And we recently just held a memorial service for a woman who had been a church member since her Universalist baptism in 1922. But the most significant hurdle I would face in reconciling the faith of my past with the congregation of my present was that of politics. Though, to be sure, we are mostly Democrats, there is a very large contingent of non-Democrats, specifically libertarians and very conservative Republicans, and yes, even a Tea Partier or two. One of these, for this morning's purposes, we'll call him Art, is a retired farmer in his 80s. He would glower at me from the pew his family has held since before he was born, whenever I would mention political agendas or hint at my own political leanings. One Sunday early in my ministry, I would pull him aside during coffee hour to seek answers to my questions and to try and reconcile my understanding of faith with his own. He would smile and gruffly say that the government didn't do him any good and that he didn't trust the government to do good for anyone else. Gruff yet appreciative of my questions, he went away from our conversation unchanged. I was confused and a bit disappointed that I couldn't seem to find any way to connect with him, or really to connect him with my ideas. But the longer I stayed at Stockton, the more I learned about Art and his work. Just before I arrived in town, neighbors whom he barely knew had a fire in their barn complex. The fire burned quickly and the barn was gone by morning. The fire department was unable to do anything to stop the loss of the structure and were there essentially to make sure the fire didn't spread to the fields or to their other buildings. But Art was there with a crew of men and women he'd assembled during the night when he heard the news. They brought shovels and rakes, but also trucks and cranes and front loaders. It was a veritable parade of equipment and labor on hand when the sun broke over the eastern horizon that morning. In a matter of hours, the still smoldering rubble would be methodically removed, and the frame of a new barn began to take shape. And in the middle of it, the story goes, was Art. NRA belonging, Tea Partying Art, relying not on the government, but on himself to get things done. This is universalism in action. And this is the lesson that Art was able to share with me, and that my call in Stockton has begun to teach me, that it isn't what one believes or how one votes that makes one a universalist. It's what one does for others. In that moment, on that crisp fall morning, Art barely knew his neighbors. He certainly wouldn't have known their political persuasions, and if he had, it wouldn't have mattered. In that moment, the only thing of importance was that his neighbor was in need, and there was no choice but to help. Now, the great universalist preacher Hosea Ballou once said that if we can agree in love, then disagreement can do us no harm. Now, this is what is so beautiful about our faith, and in particular, my little universalist congregation in Stockton. We seem to understand inherently that politics are the details, the semantics, the surface-level differences. But what allows us to come together and discuss, and even what allows our relationships to survive the dialogue, is our commitment to universalism. That as the beneficiaries of the gift of life, experiencing and sharing love is the well from which we draw our very being. This is the belief that allows us to set aside our differences and focus on what we can do together, be it comfort each other in times of loss, help each other celebrate life's great joys, help our neighbor when she is homeless or hungry, or simply live within the tragic gap, as Parker Palmer would call it, that tragic gap between what is and what ought to be. Universalism impels us to action, calls us to welcome the stranger, and always, always, always choose love over fear. When we choose to smile at a young person on the street rather than just avoid eye contact and pretend not to see the weird hair or tattoos, we're practicing universalism. When we choose to stop on the side of the road to help a fellow traveler change a tire or contact a tow truck after a breakdown, we are practicing universalism. When we defend co-workers from being ostracized because of their religion, we are practicing universalism. But for all its application and for all the reasons our world seems to need universalism now more than ever, truly practicing universalist theology is difficult. Choosing love over fear means that we cannot be afraid of difference or of the unknown. We cannot simply divide ourselves from others by skin color, income, location, gender, religion, politics, all of those things people so often use to keep us separate, make us distinct from one another. Choosing love over fear means that no matter the injury, we must all eventually forgive and ever seek forgiveness for ourselves. Choosing love over fear means that regardless of how you feel about last November's election results, we all have to come to the table and trust in our collective ability to accomplish good. Choosing love over fear means that even if you don't like a person, you have to love and respect her. This is hard. I'll admit that. But this is why I believe universalism itself is the greatest single spiritual perspective the world has ever known. It requires a person not only to form a loving relationship with the source of the cosmos, but with the rest of creation as well. It's relatively easy to define communities by superficial differences, to establish an us versus them mentality where members of one's own group seem better than the members of another. Sociologists might argue that we are comforted by our clan, that there is a survivalist advantage to sticking only to those groups of people who look and think and talk like we do. And for eons in the wilderness, this may have been true, where family groups relied upon themselves to continue the species, as it were, and to build and continue society. But the world has always been interconnected, and this has never been so apparent or so immediate as right now. Electronic impulses can carry communications around the world virtually instantaneously. What type of energy we consume, where our food comes from, what we purchase and for what purpose, all these things we do here in Northern Illinois have an impact somewhere else on Earth, whether we acknowledge it or not. The quality control or lack thereof of power plants in Asia directly affects the air quality of cities across the Pacific, including America's West Coast. Deforestation in South America leads to global climate change, not just change of the climate in the immediate area of the clear-cutting. So in addition to universalism's noble truths that inform us that we are each deserving of and responsible to love, universalism is a pragmatic theology. We are all deserving of care. We all need to care for everyone, and it is in our best interest to do so. As we look forward to the future, we must recommit to each other and the world. We must set aside superficiality and seek ever to build and maintain the connections that unite rather than divide. Might we go forth and truly live our universalism in the world, we and the rest of existence will be all the better for it. May it be so. Blessed be, and amen.